Hallo.
Hi.
Hi.
Hallo, Roshi. Hallo, Elena. Nee, Elena ist nicht da.
Bettina ist hier. Hi, oh, hi. Bettina. Ja. Hallo, Brigitte.
Hallo.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, Brigitte.
Hi, Ulla. Ulla? Ah, Ulla ist immer hier. Aha.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Wow.
I think we are a few more. I think Mike and Tanya are together.
Okay.
And I think Carsten and Katrin.
Neat. Wow, that's quite a group.
Mm-hmm. And Roger and Susanne, yes. Three more.
Oh my. Super. Super. Brigitte, you sent me an email about homework that I forgot to reply to. And you mentioned something about doing it in pairs. And I think that would be good.
So my question to Venerable Phil was if we should pair up for grading our homeworks. So maybe we, make pairs and then everybody is doing his homework and give it to the other person and the other person is grading it with the answer key.
Okay.
Right.
Good idea.
And then send me the grades.
Great.
So yeah. I can send them on to Sharae. And you can get your certificates.
As Christmas present.
All right. Okay, so let's start if everybody's ready. Last class, we actually did two classes. And we talked a little bit about the purpose of Buddhist logic. And that purpose basically is to help us understand things that are normally hidden to us. Things we can't see, taste, touch, feel, or smell. And we have to use logic to do that. We also will use logic to understand the things that are evident to us in different ways. You know, what is anger really like? You know, we experience it. What's love really like? What's the food I eat really like? And what is my reaction to that really like? You know, things like that. We normally don't think about them. But we have to understand our environment very well in order to make progress in developing our mind. It becomes very, very important to us. And then we talked about three levels of reality. And I just mentioned a couple of them. The first one is the obvious, or the evident things around us. And that's ngongyur in Tibetan. And then there's hidden things, which are kokyurs. And the classic example of something that is hidden is emptiness. We do not perceive emptiness with our senses. We cannot perceive emptiness with our senses. But we have to understand it in order to even reach nirvana, in order to really begin to eliminate our mental afflictions. And we do that through logic. And then the third level is deeply hidden phenomena. And a classic example of that is the workings of karma. And what we're talking about here is, specific things that you have done that lead to specific experiences later. We can never understand that, even through logic. We can get an appreciation of how karma works. And the more you work at this, the deeper that appreciation becomes for you. And it just keeps getting more and more profound. I've been at this 14 years. It's like I've just scratched the surface. But every couple of months I realize I now have a different understanding of karma. So that's the purpose of logic. We talked about perception. And the purpose of logic is to have a valid perception of hidden and deeply hidden phenomena in some way. And we talked about two types of perception. There's direct perception and there's deductive perception. And direct perception, our sense consciousnesses are direct perceivers. A direct perception is a perception that does not involve the conceptual mind or conceptual working in any way at all. And we have to distinguish that between deductive perception, which is where we think about things. You know, logic is a deductive process. We have some facts and we analyze them and we come up with something new. The formal process for that is called debate, but we don't have to do it with somebody else. We can do it with ourselves. And there's a type of meditation called analytical meditation, where, in fact, you do that in a very deep state of meditation. So that was the last two classes. Today, we're going to talk about what a correct perception is. Correct perception or valid perception in the school that we're studying, which is the Sautrantika school, the second philosophical school. Direct perception or correct perception and valid perception are basically the same thing. The Sanskrit word is pramana, and the Tibetan is tsema. So what is a correct perception? And the definition is, and this is from the root text, it's a state of mind that is fresh and unerring, or fresh and unmistaken. And that's the definition. It's very short. So we're going to talk about correct perception in the context of different states of mind that we can have. One state of mind, these are states of mind that are not pramana. The Tibetan is lokshe. And lokshe means that this is where we see things in a completely wrong way. Lok means reversed or turned back. And we interpret that as wrong. You know, lokshe means knowledge. So lokshe is a turned back or reversed knowledge or a wrong way. Now, this kind of perception isn't just wrong, but it understands things in the opposite way that an object exists. So the classical example is seeing things as blue or yellow, instead of their normal appearance. And this can depend on certain kinds of illness. Hepatitis typically makes your vision take on a yellow tint. Things look yellow to you. If you're under the influence of alcohol or drugs, the same thing can happen, or a strong emotion. Some people actually see things turn red when they're very angry. And there's an English expression, you may have it in German, green with envy. You're so envious of somebody that things begin to look sort of green. It doesn't happen to everybody. But that's a wrong perception. We're seeing things in the wrong way. Another state of mind that isn't a pramana is doubt. The Tibetan is tetsom. And this is where you are not sure about the object you're perceiving. Now, there are two kinds of doubt. There's one where we tend toward the wrong view of an object, and one where we tend toward the correct view of the object. Now, remember, doubt is where you're not sure about the object. An example of the first kind of doubt would be, you know, somebody asks you, is the world round or flat? And you answer, I'm not sure, but I think it's probably flat. Now, under the influence of doubt, you're not seeing the object correctly. You're not grasping the object correctly. It does not appear in a clear way to you. A third kind of state of mind that is not a valid perception and not a pramana is jeshe in Tibetan. And this is where you've seen an object and it is not now in view, but you remember what it looks like. Now, this is not a valid perception. So you've seen something like a movie, all right? And you go home and you bring up a memory of the movie and it's there, but that memory is not a valid perception. And here what we have to say is not a valid perception of the object that was the movie. Okay. It is a secondary kind of perception, an indirect perception. Kind of state of mind that is not a valid perception is something like a guess, a speculation, a guess, an assumption. It's where you presume that you know it firsthand, but you actually don't. Now, our opinions of other people are mostly this kind of perception. We really don't know things about other people. We think we do, we act as if we do, but we really don't. Why? Because we don't read their minds. Now, if you're in a relationship with somebody or you've had a friend, have been friends for, you know, 15, 20 years, you probably know a lot about that person because you've interacted with them. For most people, we just don't know, but we assume that we do. And then there's a fifth kind of perception that is not a valid perception. And this is where something appears to you, but you don't really take it in. A good example is where a child is watching a TV show and they're really into it. You know, they're engrossed in that show. And their mother says, come to dinner. And the child doesn't respond. And then she goes and shakes his shoulder and says, didn't you hear me? And the child says, well, I heard something, but I don't know what it was, you know. So that's a perception that is not a valid perception. Something appears, in this case, the sound of the mother saying, come to dinner. And the child didn't know. He said, well, I heard something, but I don't know what it was. It didn't register. So the sense consciousness, the sensory apparatus, the hearing is working fine here, but the object is not understood by the mental apparatus in your mind, you know, the thought processes. It just isn't understood. So all of these five kinds are invalid perceptions. Now, with the exception of lokshe, the first one, this is where you understand something in the completely wrong way. All the other states of mind are also kind of fuzzy. They're not clear. The lokshe, the wrong perception, is very clear and it's very incorrect. So if you honestly evaluate your perceptions during the day, you know, you'll probably find out that most of them are these fuzzy perceptions. And you begin to become aware of how you're misjudging people all the time. Meaning, you don't have valid perceptions of their thoughts or their motives or their inner being or whatever, you know. Now, we're in the Sautrantika school. But according to the highest school, the Prasangika school, You do not have a valid perception until you have a direct perception of emptiness. So in this highest school, all of our perceptions are not valid ones. But of course, there's a big debate about this, you know. It's also true in the highest school that all of our perceptions are valid perceptions, in the sense that all of our perceptions are forced on us by our karma. You know, we have no choice but to see that leaf that's blowing in front of our car as we're driving down the street. We see that leaf as a squirrel, you know, and we jam on the brakes or swerve or something to not hit the squirrel. And then as we pass by, we look out the driver's window to see the squirrel, except we see that it actually is a leaf. Now, in the highest school, us seeing the leaf as a squirrel is a valid perception. Why? Because it was forced upon us by our karma to see us that way at that moment. And later on, we see, ah, that's really a leaf, you know. And that's also a valid perception, forced on us by our karma. And now we understand that our perception of the leaf as a squirrel was mistaken. But at the time, it was a valid perception. We talk about this a lot. You know, as we get into emptiness, as we get into karma in courses, you know, 5 and 6, which a lot of you have already had, or at least some of you have, we begin to understand in a more profound way what this is all about. In the highest philosophical school, karma and emptiness are the most important things that we have to come to an understanding about, and how they work hand in hand. In the Sautrantika school, which is where this presentation from, we just went through these 5 invalid perceptions. So we're going to stick with the Sautrantika school since it's a lot simpler. Now, we're going to talk about a person who has valid perception. The person who has a valid perception all the time is a Buddha, meaning that they have no invalid perceptions of any kind. Now, here, Sema refers to a person who has pramana, who has valid perception. Sema can either be a valid perception, or it can be a person who has a valid perception. Sema itself is a state of mind. It's a state of mind that is a valid state of mind. It is a valid perception. A person and a state of mind are not the same thing, though. But here the Tibetan refers to a person who has the state of mind, tsema, right? So the Tibetan expression for a person who has valid perception is tsema kebu. Say tsema kebu. Now, kebu means an ordinary person, or just say a person. I guess a horse could be a person too. So a person, tseme kebu, a person who has valid perception. Now, according to Buddhist philosophy, a Buddhist teacher may not teach anything that he or she does not have a tsema about. Thus, we can say that Lord Buddha, who only has tsema, cannot tell a lie. Lord Buddha only speaks the truth. And one of the purposes of studying logic is to understand this deeply. And then, by hearing the speech of a Buddha, we can immediately have a realization about that topic. Now you're probably saying, oh, that's kind of nice. But this is extremely profound. If we study logic, if we debate, if we can become very quick thinkers, you know, and we're always analyzing things to find out what our perception really is my idea about this correct or incorrect, and so on. And if we get to that point, and if we can determine that a person, and it doesn't have to be a Buddha, that a person will never tell a lie, and our logic is firm enough that simply understanding that makes it true for us. It's unshakable. It's true. Then simply hearing that person say something can give us a realization. We don't have to sit down on the cushion for a year and meditate. Just hearing them say that can give us a realization. And this is very, very important. And it takes a long time to develop. So, it's important for three reasons. One of them is nirvana. Another one is omniscience. And the third one is the path to get to the first two. And this is the topic of the second chapter of the root text. Now, we don't have any samas of any of these three components. Well, maybe some of you two do. I don't know. You know, I mean, you might all be Buddhas just sitting there listening to me so I can learn what I'm talking about. But we can't even be sure that these things exist. Does nirvana exist? I don't know. You know, I have no experience in this life of nirvana. Omniscience, I have no experience in this life of omniscience. The path to get to them, I do have some experience about that. But path actually means a state of mind. So a path to reach nirvana or a path to reach omniscience is actually states of mind that you generate that will first of all remove mental afflictions so that you can reach nirvana, and then remove obstacles to omniscience so that you can reach omniscience. Now, all of these things are hidden to us. We can't perceive them except through explanations and reasoning. And the path is hidden too until we really begin to practice. And then the path becomes evident to us. It is no longer hidden. We can perceive it correctly with our mental consciousness. So, the definition of nirvana is the cessation of all our mental afflictions such that they will never occur again. So, a cessation, the ceasing of something. Nirvana is a cessation. What is it a cessation of? Our mental afflictions. And we get rid of them one by one. The cessation is such that if you remove, for example, all of the seeds that give rise to jealousy in you, then jealousy can never, ever again occur to you. It will never, ever be in your mind again. Why? Because there are no seeds for it to occur. Why do we get angry? Why do we get jealous? Why do we become afraid and so on? It is because whenever one of those emotions occur, we do the exact wrong thing about it and replant the seed that has just ripened. When your boss yells at you and you yell back, you plant the seed for having your boss yell at you again. Now, if the time comes for you to get angry, where you normally get angry about something, and you don't replant the seed that made that anger occur in the first place. You're still going to have lots of other seeds in your bag, right? And they will ripen one by one. But if you get to a point where you don't respond, where you don't get angry at these seeds ripening, that might make you angry, then they will eventually all disappear. And you will never get angry again. Why? Because you have no seeds for that to happen. You know, if you're a gardener or a farmer and you've planted a crop of corn, you're going to get corn. And the corn comes up and you eat it all or give it away or do both, and there's no corn left, you won't have any corn to plant the next crop. So you will not have corn again. It's like that. So nirvana is the cessation of every single one of your mental afflictions. When the last seed for the remaining mental affliction is eliminated, then you are in nirvana. And that will happen in a lifetime. I mean, you will be a person when that happens. And it's said that when that happens, you have nirvana with remainder. What's the remainder? It is your body. Your body is the result of contaminated karma. But when it comes time for you to die, you will then be in nirvana without remainder. You have no body. You just have this mind that is meditating on bliss for the rest of eternity. And that's nirvana. No more suffering ever again for you. Now, omniscience is the state of all-knowingness, you know. Omniscience is the mind of a Buddha. A Buddha knows everything without any obstructions whatsoever. There's no obstruction of time. There's no obstruction of space. All the perceptions are valid, correct, all the time. And that's omniscience. So omniscience is the cessation of your mental obstructions to knowledge. On the Bodhisattva path, which most of us are on, the first thing you do is remove the mental afflictions. And when you have a direct perception of emptiness, you enter the first Bodhisattva ground, and there are 10 of those. On the first 6 Bodhisattva grounds, you purify one by one the 6 perfections. On the 7th Bodhisattva ground, you are now at the equivalent of nirvana for somebody who is not on the Mahayana path, meaning that you've removed all of your mental afflictions. And what you do on 7, 8, 9, and 10 is remove the obstructions to knowledge. And on the 10th level, when you remove that last obstruction to knowledge, boom, you become a Buddha, just like that. So, and path is the particular state of mind that is able to eliminate afflictions and obstacles. So these three things, nirvana, omniscience, and path, are the reasons that we need to understand what pramana is and how we use logic to get at the things that we cannot perceive directly through our senses. We talked about doubt, you know. Even if you think that there probably is nirvana or probably is omniscience, you know, you're still doubtful about it. Probably, you know, you have, yeah, I think they're there. When you first heard about them, you say, nah, bunch of new age stuff, you know. But you may not have been sure. So that you had that first kind of doubt, the doubt that tends toward the incorrect view. And now, hopefully, as a result of these courses you're taking, you think, yeah, I think that nirvana and omniscience probably do exist. I think that. And that will become stronger and stronger to you. So in order to develop a valid perception of those things, you must use logic to convince yourself, you know, that they do exist and to get a good idea of what they really are. So we talked about two kinds of tsema in the last class, direct perception and deductive reasoning. Now, a direct perception does not depend on reasoning. For example, you may be looking at a pen. The color is blue. You have a direct perception of blue or any other colors that the pen might be. You have a direct perception of cylinder and other things. You know, you don't depend on reasoning to get that. And then in your mind comes the thing pen. You know, oh, that's a pen. And that itself is a direct mental perception. Now, it's not a direct perception of pen, but the fact that you've named it pen, that's a pen, and that you're aware of that, that is a direct perception. You don't have to reason it out that that's a pen. Now, it turns out that there is a very quick mental process that you go through in order to identify pen or horse or wife or food or whatever. And it happens, you know, in a split second. But it's pretty involved, and we'll talk about that at some point. Now, so that's direct perception. Direct perceptions do not depend on reasoning. When you have a direct perception of emptiness, your mental consciousness is perceiving that directly. The conceptual apparatus isn't operating then. You are simply perceiving things directly with your mental consciousness. It takes a lot of preparation to get there, but you can perceive things directly with your mental consciousness. And the first thing that you'll perceive that way is emptiness. And then we have deductive reasoning. Deductive reasoning does depend on reasoning, you know, and it depends on good reasons that lead you to see something. And then there are three kinds of deductive reasoning. The first one is logical reasoning. And this is used to perceive things that are hidden to us. We've already talked about that several times. The second kind of deductive reasoning is belief in an authority. And this is used to perceive deeply hidden things. For example, karma. A person of authority tells us about deeply hidden things. And then we use reasoning to convince ourselves that the authority cannot lie. So, the example that we've already given of a deeply hidden thing is the laws of karma. And who do we rely on? Lord Buddha. He explained how things work. And the third type of deductive reasoning is something we call convention. This is where everybody agrees on something. When everybody agrees on something, it's generally accepted to be what people think it is. For example, we call the thing we write with a pencil. Okay, then when we hear pencil, we know that that is what's being talked about. And you know, our life is mostly that. Even when we're thinking about things, it's sort of a discussion going on in our minds. You know, using concepts, using terms for things, we often call these labels. It's kind of like the label that you see, the price label you see in a thing at the grocery store. But a label's more than that. It's a kind of a template that we apply to organize data that comes in from our senses. And those are concepts. They're conceptions. So if I could convince you, you know, that there really is such a thing as nirvana, so that you had a tsema of nirvana, your life would change. You would know for a fact, you know, at an intellectual level, that you don't have to die, that you don't have to suffer. Nirvana is the removal of all of your mental afflictions. It is our mental afflictions that cause our death. So we don't have to die. You know, it can get to the point that as we're looking at our arm, you know, which now is covered with stuff and maybe a little hairy and might have some spots on it and so on, and we're looking at that, that could turn into an arm of light. There's nothing that says it couldn't. What we are seeing now is forced on us by our karma. We could just be as easily be looking at a paw, you know. That would be forced on us by our karma. We're not looking at a paw. We're looking at an arm. So we could be looking at the arm of an enlightened being, you know, at a light body. That's entirely possible. So those are the topics for today's class. It's kind of short, but very, very deep. And I encourage you to spend some time with the reading, you know, thinking about it, going over and over and over the things in the reading, meditating about them, to get a good handle on why logic is important. We really haven't gotten to how you use it, well, as to how it works yet, which we will. But in order to do that, you ought to have a good reason why you should make the effort. And I hope I've sort of encouraged you to do that. So if there are any questions, we can take them now.
Yes, I have one question. In the reading, sometimes there is used the word valid and sometimes the word correct for perception. Right. Is that the same or is there a difference? That's a translator question, I know.
Yes, it is. They are the same. But I guess now I can confuse you. The word pramana, means typically fresh, like something you've just taken out of the oven or you've picked a fresh apple off the tree or something like that. It's fresh. It's new. So in the South Tantrika school, a valid perception is something which is fresh. It's just appeared to you. In the South Tantrika school, when you have a valid perception, for example, you put your pen in front of your eyes and pen, the first moment where a moment is, you know, 1/64th of the finger snap is a pramana because it's fresh. It just happened. And then the subsequent moments of that are not valid perceptions. We don't really discuss this much in this course because it doesn't make a lot of difference. But in the South Tantrika school, a pramana is only the first moment of a perception of something. And then it's no longer fresh. Now, in the Prasangika school and the schools underneath, well, maybe we could say the middle way school, I think it's the Prasangika school. The schools lower than that all go to this idea of fresh. But pra also means valid or correct. So the Prasangika school says that any perception you have is valid because it is occurring due to your karma. It cannot be anything else. So the difference between the South Tantrika and the Prasangika school has to do with how they use the word pra in their understanding of what pramana means. In the lower schools, a pramana is simply a fresh perception. To be correct and valid, it must be fresh. So when they say correct, that's what they're talking about. When they say valid, that's what they're talking about. In the Prasangika school, when they say valid or correct, they're talking about the fact that all perceptions are valid or correct because that's what appears to us, forced on us by our karma. Now, that sort of sheds a different understanding of things like insanity. You know, an insane person, by definition, doesn't perceive reality correctly. But in the Prasangika school, since they're forced by their karma to see things like that, they are valid perceptions for that person. So to answer your question, valid and correct mean the same thing.
Okay, thank you. okay, yeah.
Oh, that could lead to a question. If we talk about valid perception, and you're saying, I'm not sure whether I understood this right, but are you saying it's subjective? Because if I as an individual perceive something, and because it creates my reality, it's always valid. Is that what one school says? But then, if that was the case, there was no objective valid perception, which is what you talked about verse 5, incorrect perception. There is this objective kind of view and an objective, and we are talking objective, right?
Yes. Everything in Buddhism is subjective. Meaning is held by the mind. The mind is the subject. The Tibetan mind, subject, I guess, in Tibetan is yulchen, which means it holds an object. It has an object. So yul is object. It's the thing out there, okay? But the subject, the mind that perceives that, is a yulchen. It holds the object. So everything is subjective from a Buddhist point of view. Everything we perceive. Now, in the lower schools, there is something out there which we try to perceive. Sometimes well, sometimes not so well. But in the highest school, in the Prasangika school, even what's out there is a projection of our karma, is the result of our karma. It doesn't mean it's not real. I mean, you go outside and stand in the middle of a highway and a truck comes along and hits you. You know, the truck's a projection. You were a projection. Being hit is a projection. You know, you're taken to the hospital in a projected ambulance and so on. And you're treated by projected doctors, and, you know, you pay for that with projected money you have in your bank. All of those things are real, but they are projections of your mind, projections of your karma. So when you get right down to it, it's subjective.
Yes, thank you. Very helpful.
I have another question.
Uh-huh.
So is there a path only to nirvana without omniscience?
Yes.
Okay.
There are two kinds of... Well, in the Lam Rim, which Geshe-la is teaching, he's on up to a 15-year project now. He's going through the entire Lam Rim. And there are three kinds of practitioners. The first level is people who simply want a good rebirth, meaning they want to be reborn as a human or one of the two levels of pleasure being, but not as an animal, a hungry ghost, or in the hells. So that's level one. They just want a good rebirth. That's all they can manage. The second level is people are fed up with suffering. They understand that the world doesn't work for them, and they want out. And their goal then is nirvana. the removal of all their mental afflictions. And having done that, there are no more rebirths in misery or anywhere. They're just in bliss for the remainder of eternity. And then the third level understands, yes, the world doesn't work for me, and it doesn't work for anybody else either. And everybody around me has been my mother in previous lifetimes, since there's an infinite number of those, you know. And I haven't done a thing to repay the kindness that these mothers have shown me. So I'm going to get myself enlightened so that I can take them out of suffering as well. And that's the third level. And those people are called bodhisattvas. And the only way that you can reach omniscience is to have the welfare of everybody else foremost in your mind. If you're just doing it for yourself, that works and you reach nirvana. But if everybody else also, then you can go on and remove the obstacles to omniscience and become a Buddha.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
I have another one. Would a Buddha, the embodiment of compassion, ever judge another person?
Yes. Why? Because they have valid perceptions of that person. Where judge means to evaluate their situation and how the Buddha itself should respond.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it depends on how I interpret judge in that context. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
They do not ever not love us. Mm. So judgment sort of means that.
Mm-hmm.
But they always love us. They always show compassion.
Okay, thank you.
But isn't it so that you always judge when you make a decision?
Well, if we use judge on, let's say, that guy's crazy or dumb or stupid or whatever, that's a judgment about their character. And the problem with that is we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as bodhisattvas, we're required to help people at all times. If we see a person being mugged, we go help. The example Geshe likes to give is, you know, walking up the street and a woman and somebody's trying to take her purse. You know, you are required to go help as a bodhisattva. Now, you don't know why or what's going on between the two of them. It may be that the woman has in her purse a radio transmitter that is going to detonate an explosive in a building. And the guy trying to take the purse away knows that. All right. Is trying to get away. And there can be other scenarios, you know, that are possible. We don't know what's going on. We normally make a snap judgment that that's a thief, you know, really bad guy trying to hurt this innocent person. And that's a judgment. Now, we do have to act based on the way things are appearing to us. You know, it looks like this guy's trying to take this woman's purse, and it's her property, and that shouldn't be going on, so you go help. If it turns out that you've misjudged, and in fact she does have a radio transmitter and is going to detonate an explosive, you will know that soon enough. But you don't just stand there going through all these different scenarios, you know, trying to figure out should I act or should I not act when you really don't know what's going on and wind up doing nothing. You've got to act. So this judgment, people, that Lord Buddha was talking about, not judging somebody else, That judgment is a kind of sustained thought that you have. You know, the example he gave himself in a previous life, that, you know, that he judged another monk, that what the monk was teaching was incorrect. He held that view for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That was a judgment.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. You know, another example of that, I don't think your election process goes on as long as it does here in the United States. But presidential elections, and we're in the middle of one, they've been going on for almost 2 years now. And you get a pretty heavy dose of what each candidate is saying, especially what they're saying about the other person. And we develop opinions about those. And if we don't really check out whether something is true or not, then we have judged the two people involved, or the four people, or however many it is. We have to use logic. You know, what is this person's position? Now, it turns out that they never really say much about what their positions are, which is unfortunate. You know, they just say why the other person is worse. That doesn't help at all. But that's the kind of thing, you know. Is Obama a better candidate than Romney? I don't think anybody knows, frankly. Certainly nothing they've said convinces anybody. A lot of people are convinced by what their opponent says about them. You know, that Obama's is evil incarnate because that's what Romney says, or that Romney is the same, you know, because that's what Obama says. There are people who believe that, and they're judging. They really haven't looked into it. And they're going to have horrible karmic consequences because of that. We've got to be careful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else?
Yeah, this is Christian from Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about objectives, like next life to be reborn as a human being, or Nirvana, Bodhisattva. How do I get a valid perception of what is the correct objective for myself?
I think you kind of look into your heart and say, can I dedicate my life to helping everybody else? And if you can, then you're going for omniscience. If you can't, but you are fed up with suffering, then you dedicate to just removing your mental afflictions. Now, removing your mental afflictions, whether you're going for nirvana or whether you're going for omniscience, is pretty much the same thing. It happens more quickly if you're going for omniscience, because this thought of great compassion, bodhicitta it's called, the mind of enlightenment, is very powerful. And it changes the power of the karma you generate as you're keeping vows, you know, trying to eliminate your mental afflictions. But you basically have to say, you know, what can I do reasonably? What's my mental state? And then that's what you go for. And you take the rest of the courses and figure out what you have to do. You develop a meditation practice so you can really begin to look at your mind, because the mind is the collection of the karma you have. And you've got to know that in order to get rid of the seeds that haven't ripened yet. Plant new seeds, and you plant new seeds by taking vows and keeping them, which we haven't talked about. That's a big topic in course 7.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. If that's it, then call it a night.
Thank you so much, Venerable Phil, for teaching.
You're very well.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This week's speaking.
Okay, then I finish the call, and the German translation will be available latest tomorrow evening, dinner time.
Wow.
Dessert, you can have the German class.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Venerable Phil. See you next week.
Okay. See you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.